galaxy is ultimately a fantasy. It's not just a dream, it's a nightmare. And then when the soul returns to the spiritual world, the entire experience of many, many trillions of lifetimes appears just like one passing nightmare, having lasted perhaps a few seconds. Even though we may have dreamt of so many things, but when we wake up we realize it's just a few seconds. We were only dreaming for a few moments, not more. So also this, our sojourn in the material world is like that. For our point of view, it appears so large. Every day, every year, every lifetime. When millions and trillions of lifetimes pass for us, and that's nothing for Krishna. What to speak of Krishna, even for Mahavishnu? His one breath, just his exhalation, his outward breath, is the entire lifespan of the whole universe, consisting of 311 trillion years. So the material energy can be positively used for Krishna's service. And then Maya will actually help us to go back to Godhead. Just as, suppose we are going into some house and that owner has kept a pet dog who is very ferocious. And when we go inside, the dog makes threatening noises and aggressively advances towards us. And we may try to control the dog in our own way. But it will be difficult. It will have its problems. However, if we simply inform the owner that I have come, please take care of your dog, immediately the owner shouts out the name of the dog and the dog immediately wags his tail and comes away from there. So then that dog will actually protect us when we go into that house. So in the same way, Maya is a maidservant of the Lord. And therefore, she follows His instructions. Icchānu rūpam api yasya ca cheṣṭate sa govindamāda purusham tamaham bhajāme. So she is very obedient to the will of Krishna. Otherwise, Maya is impossible to overcome. Mama maya duratyaya daivihi esha gunamayi. So this material mode, this material energy is extremely difficult to overcome. But for one who surrenders to me, mayam etam tarantite, one can easily cross over. Mam evaya prapadyante. So by surrendering to Krishna, then Krishna gives the instruction to the material energy. You keep away from this individual. Keep away from this soul. Don't put him or her into trouble now. Now, this soul is under my control. You are there only to keep away all the unqualified people, just like the dog is at the gate to keep away the thieves and the other unwanted elements. But this is my guest. So the owner tells the dog, don't trouble him now. Then the dog will come and lick the newcomer's feet. So Maya Devi, with all her opulences and everything, she is ever waiting to serve the devotee of the Lord when the devotee becomes pure. Then Krishna just instructs, now I transfer him from your charge to my direct charge. Of course, even when the devotee is, the conditioned soul is under Maya's charge, he is still under Krishna's charge, but indirectly. When the conditioned soul becomes a devotee, then Krishna takes personal charge. And at that time, Maya doesn't have a role to play. She says, all right, now, my Lord, you wish to directly deal with this soul. This soul is very fortunate. So in fact, now I will assist you in your desire, because that is your desire. In this way, Maya actually will assist in her capacity as Yoga Maya, in her purified original form as Yoga Maya, she will then assist the devotee in his or her onward journey towards the spiritual world. So this is Krishna's direct intervention. So it's all a matter of surrender to Krishna. Srila Prabhupada here is talking in this paragraph about how one should live our life. How Arjuna led his life. He took an important decision in his life based on Krishna's instructions. That's all we need to do. All the important decisions we take in our life should be based upon what pleases Krishna. From the smallest decisions in our life to the biggest decisions. It's not our pleasure that is a standard for taking decisions. But it's Krishna's pleasure. What will help us in our devotional service to Krishna? That is the criterion. So then Prabhupada has broadened the concept of Yukta Vairagya to our very way of living, lifestyle. Not just a question of utilizing things in Krishna's service, but a whole mental state, a whole attitude, state of frame of mind about how we look at the world itself. This is Krishna's property, it's Krishna's energy, and that I have to use it only to serve Krishna. I have to interact with this energy only for the pleasure of Krishna. So therefore, as we have discussed before, in Sambandha Jnana, it is not necessary only to know the relation between the Jiva and Krishna, but to also know the interrelationship between Jiva, material energy, and Krishna. All three are very important. So let us go ahead to see how sometimes people wrongly deal with the material energy and then create so many problems for themselves. Last paragraph of page 16. In this world, men are not meant for quarreling like cats and dogs. Men must be intelligent to realize the importance of human life and refuse to act like ordinary animals. A human being should realize the aim of his life, and this direction is given in all Vedic literatures, and the essence is given in Bhagavad Gita. Vedic literature is meant for human beings, not for animals. Animals can kill other living animals, and there is no question of sin on their part. But if a man kills an animal for the satisfaction of his uncontrolled taste, he must be responsible for breaking the laws of nature. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is clearly explained that there are three kinds of activities according to the different modes of nature. The activities of goodness, of passion, and ignorance. Unquote. So here, Prabhupada is mentioning the importance of the human form of life. It is only in the human form that there is a great responsibility on how we should act. In other species of life, the living entities act simply according to impulse. According to the urges of the body and mind, they act. That's all. But these urges of the body and mind, the human being is supposed to resist. Shad Vegam. It's called the six Vegas, the six pushings of the mind and the body. We all know this verse very well, isn't it? What verse is that? Vacho Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam, Jivva Vegam, Udara Upastha Vegam. These are the six Vegas, the six pushings of the mind and the body. So, the animals act only according to these six pushings. They know no other life. They act on impulse, just like a child. So, a child is somewhat like an animal because the child also acts according to his impulse. The child will pick up anything and eat, put in his mouth. The child will throw anything anywhere. Has no sense of discrimination. Only according to what feels pleasurable for the body and the mind and the senses, the child or the animal, they do that. But if a human being acts like that, then he is responsible and he is punished. Why is a human being punished and not an animal? Prabhupada says here that animals can kill other living animals and there is no question of sin. But if a human being does it for his gratification, then he is punished. So why is it that the human beings only are penalized in this way? Yes. So human being has got higher intelligence. So? Yes, a human being has higher intelligence, and therefore with that intelligence he can understand what is good and bad. Yes, go on. Okay, he doesn't understand. So why punish him? Yes. That may be, but if he doesn't use it, why penalize him? If you have money and don't spend it, should I punish you? Okay, I'm looking for one word. Yes.
Animal kills animal because that is its food. Animal's food. But if man kills animal, that is not the human being.
If the animal kills an animal, that is his food. If a human being kills an animal, that is not his food according to the laws of nature, therefore he is punished. Yes. But that is a particular answer for this particular thing. But a general answer I'm seeking as to why is it that only man or humanity in all the species are penalized and not others? So, that's the point I'm asking, that we have advanced intelligence, so what? Why punish you because you have advanced intelligence? Yes, that's the word we're looking for. Responsibility. With higher gifts, higher powers, come higher responsibilities. When there is more intelligence given, when there is more capability given, there is higher position given in the hierarchy, then more responsibility is expected. And if you deviate, then you are penalized more. Just like if an ordinary person in a hierarchy commits a mistake, he may be penalized. But if the top person does the same mistake, he will be penalized much more.
Sir, there is different explanation in the Shastra. They say all these beings, except human body, they are bhogyoni, they are not tamgoni.
That's alright. They are bhogyonis, but my question is why? Yes, they are bhogyonis, we accept. The question is, why are they only bhogyonis? Why are they not responsible? Why only human beings are penalized? Why is it that human being, the other yonis are only bhogyonis? Because the human being has a higher intelligence. That higher intelligence is meant to be used by God's arrangement for a higher purpose. If that intelligence which is superior is not utilized for the purpose that is ordained by God, then we are deviating from that very great responsibility, and therefore we are punishable in the eyes of God. Whereas the animals, they don't have that level of intelligence. They don't have the quality in them to understand God or realize absolute truth. But human being has that. And if he doesn't use it, because it is a gift of God for that exclusive purpose, he is misusing his responsibility for a higher life, using it for a lower purpose which is available to the animals, so therefore he is penalized. And for the same offense, different people may be punished differently. Is it a fact? It's not that the same offense can always yield the same punishment everywhere. Although generally it may be true, but there are exceptions. So if the top person does something, then people will criticize, just like when we were discussing Chaitanya Leela. We heard Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saying, Sanyasira Alpachitra Sarvaloke Gai. That if there is a small flaw to be found in a sannyasi, it becomes like a big thing. Whereas an ordinary person does the same thing, it's not considered so big. The act is the same. But because so much more is expected of the sannyasi, he is on an elevated platform, supposed to be higher than everybody else. So when he does something that is not correct, that may be done ordinarily by other people, but it is more severely criticized. Similarly, the human form of life is the highest species, the highest form in the creation. And much is expected because of that sense of responsibility that is due that is existing, that is given to him. And if he doesn't utilize that, then he's punished. A similar argument can be said even for those who have been born in India. India is known as Punya Bhumi. So for those who are born in this land, who are born and brought up with the culture of God, of Ram, of Krishna, of Narasimha, of Prahlad, of devotional service, of temples, of worship. Having been brought up in this culture, if they reject this, and if they commit sinful activities, they are punished more severely than others for the same offense, because they should know better. Because they are supposed to be special who have been born here. And having got this advantage, having got this special facility, you misuse it, then the punishment is more severe. So this is the special boon of human life. If we can utilize it well, we can use it for very great advantage to liberate ourselves, to make a permanent solution to all our problems. And if we don't use it well, then it can propel us down to the lowest of the lower species of life. We can go down and remain in this cycle for a long, long time. So this is the significance of the human form of life. To whom much is given, much is expected. So much is given to the human being. Higher intelligence, higher facilities, higher capabilities. But if we don't use it for the purpose for which it has been given to us, then we are punished. So we'll go ahead, page 17. And by the way, what exactly is sin? Because Prabhupada says there is no question of sin on their part. What is sin?
Not following the laws.
Not following the laws of God. Very simple definition. It's correct. Not following the laws of God is sin. Just like not following the law of the land is crime. Anyone who is a criminal is liable to be punished. So anyone who violates the laws of God is also liable to be punished. The same argument we can give here. If a motorist, if a driver who is driving a car, jumps a red signal at the traffic light, he is immediately hauled up by the police and fined or punished. But if a dog is on the road and he jumps the red light, will the policeman run after him to fine him? Will the dog be fined? Why not? Hasn't he broken the law? He doesn't have understanding. So the police, the law of the land is not meant for the animals. So the concept of crime is not meant for animals. It is meant for human beings. Similarly, the concept of sin is meant for human beings. It's not meant for the animals. One is living an animal life because of sin performed in the human life. So the animal species, the lower species of life, are received as a result of sin performed earlier. So therefore the human form of life is a very important junction. It is from this junction that we can decide which way to go. On a railway junction you have so many options. You can go in different directions, take connecting trains to different places. We may have come from somewhere, and we have options to go to many other places from that junction. So also human form of life is that junction. You can go so many different destinations. You can take a choice. You can take your pick. But that is not so in the lower species. In the lower species you don't have a choice. Once you have come down to a particular level in the insects or plants or aquatics or the animals or birds, then you only move upwards automatically. In a program sequence, according to your past karma in the human life, you have a certain destined span of time to be lived out in each of these species. Maybe not all the species right through to the human form. Maybe you jump over some species. Maybe you just go couple of species back to human form. It's very complicated. no fixed law. That mechanical, it's not a mechanical thing. The laws of karma will take into account many, many things. But once the jiva comes down into one of the lower species, there's only one direction to go, and that is up. Till you come to the human form. Having come to the human form, then again we can decide which way to go. To remain in the human species, to go up and down in the human species, to go up to the higher species in the higher planets in this world, to go lower down in the lower species, or to be liberated from this material existence, to go to Vaikuntha, to go to Goloka, to go to Brahman. So many options available for the human being. So therefore, intelligence means to take the right, make the right choices. That is what intelligence means. That we use our intelligence to make the right choice about our future. That is human intelligence. So we'll begin reading again. Page 17. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is clearly explained that there are three kinds of activities according to the different modes of nature. The activities of goodness, of passion, and ignorance. Similarly, there are three kinds of eatables also. Eatables in the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance. All of this is clearly described. And if we properly utilize the instructions of Bhagavad Gita, then our whole life will become purified. And ultimately, we will be able to reach the destination which is beyond the material sky. Yad gatvana nivartante tad dhama paramam mama. Unquote. So the three modes of material nature, as we have discussed before, are all pervading. Everything is constituted of the three modes in this material world. Just like all colors in this world are a combination of three primary colors. Which are they? Yellow, red, green, blue, not green. So red, yellow, and blue. These are three primary colors. And by mixing these colors in different proportions, you can get different colors. And some computer, I believe, they generated something like 81 million colors. So there was somebody was saying in one lecture one day, one devotee was explaining that some computer has come up with a program where there's so many millions of combinations of colors. So they take the credit for it. Paint companies, they bring their own colors and they say, this is our credit. But who has made all these colors? The colors were not originally made by us. So everything in the world also, just like it is for colors, it's also for the modes. Everything is a combination of the modes here. Everyone is struggling against the modes. Everything is influenced by the modes. This is a unique concept that is there only in the Vedic sciences. The concept of the modes of nature doesn't exist in other philosophies. So by this we can understand very clearly how the material nature is working. And we will see application of this concept everywhere in our shastras. Even in Bhagavatam we can see. Even in the time of the demigods and the asuras fighting, sometimes the demigods win, sometimes the asuras win. And Parikshit Maharaj asks Shukadev Goswami, why was the Lord partial to the demigods? Because the demons are as much a part and parcel of him as the demigods. So why did he side with the demigods and assist them in killing the demons? And Shukadev Goswami replied that this concept of partiality and impartiality doesn't exist in the Supreme Lord's dictionary. For him, he is always equal to everyone. Samoham sarvabhuteshu name dveshyah stina priyaha. So he neither envies anybody nor is partial to anyone. It's only that victory and defeat happen according to the modes of nature. That's one of the explanations Shukadev Goswami gave, among others. He said the demons are in the mode of passion and ignorance. So when these modes become powerful, the demons become victorious. The demigods are in the mode of goodness. So when the mode of goodness is in the upswing, then the demigods emerge victorious. So therefore sometimes the demons win, sometimes the demigods win. So that's the way the material energy functions, up and down in cycles. The modes are moving according to their own way, under the dictates of the Supreme Lord. The modes are moving up and down, and all of us are simply puppets in the hands, the conditioned souls are puppets in the hands of the three modes, floating up and down with the different modes. So real freedom means to become free from these three modes. Nowadays we find everybody is seeking independence. Human beings want independence, children want independence, employees want independence. Everybody wants independence. The number of countries is increasing because states want to break off from the mother country to form their own country. Everybody wants to become independent more and more and more. But this is not real independence. Real independence means to become free from the three modes. What's the use of just becoming free from one master and going to another master? Who is material? Better to just take shelter of the Supreme Master, Sri Krishna. That is real freedom. And when we achieve that platform by the process of devotional service, then that real freedom means we go to that real sky which is free, full of freedom, where we can move anywhere, the eternal sky. Yat gatva na nivartante tat dhama parama mama, as Krishna says, once one goes there is no coming back. So that is the place of real freedom. If at all we want to work towards freedom, it should be that. Not the artificial political freedom of today. So let's read the next paragraph. More about that destination which is beyond the material sky. Second paragraph on page 17. That destination is called the Sanatan sky, the eternal spiritual sky. In this material world, we find that everything is temporary. It comes into being, stays for some time, produces some byproducts, dwindles, and then vanishes. That is the law of the material world. Whether we use as an example this body or a piece of fruit or anything. Unquote. So the main characteristic of this world, material world, is that everything is temporary. And because it is temporary, what's the next characteristic? What follows after being temporary? If something is temporary, then it is a cause of what? Suffering. It's logical. If something is temporary, it is a cause of suffering. Why so? Yes? Not you may. You may lose that. You will lose that. Isn't it? So, you have something. You are going to use it. We are attached to our youth. And all the enjoyment that comes out of youth, that's temporary. Old age will come. And the suffering of old age will come. And the health and pleasures of youth will go. Suffering will be there. And even old age will not be permanent. Death will come. But even death is not permanent. Then birth will come. So therefore, birth, death, old age, disease, janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi, dukkha, dosha, anudarshanam. So a wise person understands that these are the four basic miseries. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. These are the two characteristics. Because everything is ashashvatam, it is temporary, therefore it is dukkhalayam. Eternal life means happy life. Temporary life means suffering. So in this world, because everything is temporary, therefore there cannot be any happiness here. And it is foolish to try to make arrangements for attaining happiness in this temporary world where happiness is not possible. It's just like somebody sitting in a jail trying to construct his own life and make all kinds of plans for happiness. Ultimately, what happiness can you have in a jail? So always remembering that everything will be finished, the devotee has to target on the eternal. And it is a fact. It's not only a question of whether, it's a question of when. Chanakya Pandit says that a person who is really intelligent reflects on the temporary nature of this world and acts according to the principle that everything will be destroyed the very next moment. And then he is eligible for spiritual success. A person who doesn't think like that cannot attain success. In fact, Chanakya Pandit says, if a person wants to achieve material success, he should think that he will live forever. Otherwise, he will not have the enthusiasm to go on. If he's always going to think everything will be finished, what to do, then he will, why should I work so hard? Why should I give so much trouble to myself? So when somebody is an illusion, then he can try for happiness in this world. Because the only way he can do that is to forget death, to forget the temporary nature of this world. That is the nature of Maya. Ahanya ahani bhutani gacchanti ha yamalyam sheshah sthavaram icchanti kim aashcharyam atah param. Every day we see living entities going to the kingdom of Yamaraj, to the abode of death. But still those who are remaining behind feel that we will remain forever. So if somebody is intelligent, then he or she should understand the temporary nature of this world and immediately focus on the eternal aspect of life. Even in the course of our devotional service, we sometimes may tend to get carried away by the temporary troubles, even in our devotional service. But ultimately, through all these temporary ups and downs, if we simply focus and fix our mind on the eternal, then we will be able to tide through all these various ups and downs easily. The point is to remain fixed in the eternal so as to not get swept away by the temporary. In Haridwar and Rishikesh, when you go to bathe in the Ganges, the current of the water is so strong that usually nobody goes inside, deep inside, because you will simply reach Calcutta. You won't need a ticket. You can just go straight down. Free ticket to Calcutta or the Bay of Bengal. But if you want to take bath, then the administration there has provided very strong iron chains which are on the banks. So you catch hold of those chains and then take your dip and then come out again. So even though the current is very strong, and if you leave the chains, you'll get swept. But because you're holding on to those chains, then you can be there, take the benefit of the bath, and still come out and still remain in Haridwar or Rishikesh. Similarly, in this world, the current of material existence is very strong, sweeping us from one destination to another, from one situation to another. Everything is temporary. Is anything permanent in the river? Can you construct some nice thing with straw and then expect it to remain? It gets swept away. Everything gets swept away. So the current of this material ocean, the river of material existence, is very powerful. It sweeps us away. Temporary situations come and every now and then. And we've just got over one situation and another comes knocking, and another, and another. And if we are going to become carried away by these temporary situations, we will never be able to reach the eternal sky, the Sanatana sky. So therefore, in the midst of all these dualities and the ups and downs of the material atmosphere, we must fix our mind on the iron chains of the eternal sky. That is the process of Krishna consciousness. In that way, we will be able to remain stable and happy even in the midst of this turbulent material world. We can remember and we can realize that whatever may be happening in my life, Krishna is still playing the flute here in Vrindavan. That doesn't change. Krishna is still grazing the cows in Ramanreti and in Govardhan. Krishna is still doing the Rasa Leela with the gopis. Mother Yashoda is still cooking some nice dishes for Krishna. That is going on, eternally happening. So our consciousness should be focused on the eternal even when we are here in the temporary. So our feet should be in the real, in the so-called real world as we are existing now, and our consciousness should be in the really real world, the spiritual sky. Vastava matra vastu shivadam tapatrayon mulanam. The second verse of the Bhagavatam says that from the Srimad Bhagavatam we can understand the really real substance, that is Krishna, and the absolute truth. This material world is falsely real. It appears, it gives a semblance of being permanent. It gives an appearance that it is permanent, but actually it is not. So all we have to do is to remember that spiritual sky. Remember what is going on over there. Krishna has come down here 5,000 years ago to give us a glimpse of what happens over there. These descriptions are found in the scriptures like the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Bhagavad Gita, of course, gives us only a hint that such a world exists in just 5 or 6 verses, that's all. But information about what actually goes on there is there in these other wonderful scriptures. So when we hear about these descriptions and focus on them in our mind, then nothing in this material atmosphere will shake us too much. We will remain always steady and strong and never deviate from our path home back to the eternal sky. So let's continue. Further descriptions of this Sanatan sky. But beyond this temporary world, there is another world of which we have information. That world consists of another nature, which is Sanatan, eternal. Jiva is also described as Sanatan, eternal. And the Lord is also described as Sanatan in the 11th chapter. We have an intimate relationship with the Lord, and because we are all qualitatively one, the Sanatan Dharma or sky, the Sanatan Supreme Personality and the Sanatan Living Entities, the whole purpose of Bhagavad Gita is to revive our Sanatan occupation or Sanatan Dharma, which is the eternal occupation of the living entity. We are all temporarily engaged in different activities, but all these activities can be purified when we give up all these temporary activities and take up the activities which are prescribed by the Supreme Lord. That is called pure life. Unquote. So the word eternal or Sanatan is used many times. Yes, that is what Krishna consciousness is all about. The eternal soul has an eternal relationship with the eternal Lord in the eternal sky. So to revive this eternal function is Krishna consciousness. So somehow we have come from an eternal realm and we have meant to go back to that eternal realm. So these things are very encouraging. They give hope in a world of hopelessness. If we simply look at the newspapers, look at the world around us, look at the way people behave, the way everything is, the world is nowadays, it gives a feeling of despair and hopelessness. But when you look at the spiritual sky and the reality, then immediately there is hope. Yes, this is real life. This is the real world. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come here to bring that eternal sky down here available to everyone. So we can participate in our preaching mission very, very strongly, so that everyone else can also get hope in life. It is not false hope. It is real hope about an eternal future in the eternal sky with the eternal Lord, participating in pastimes of eternal joy, eternal knowledge. Next para. The Supreme Lord and His transcendental abode are both Sanatan. As are the living entities, and the combined association of the Supreme Lord and all the living entities in the Sanatan abode is the perfection of human life. Unquote. So Prabhupada is saying here, the combined association of the Supreme Lord and the living entities in the Sanatan abode is the perfection of human life. Combined association. Even the Lord is seeking the association of the devotees. The Lord doesn't like to be alone. The devotees don't like to be alone. So the combined association of the Lord and His devotees in the Sanatan sky is the perfection of human life. Continue. The Lord is very kind to the living entities, because they are His sons. Lord Krishna declares in the Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Yonishu Aham Bija Pradhapita. I am the father of all. Of course, there are all types of living entities according to their various karmas. But here the Lord claims that He is the father of all of them. Therefore, the Lord descends to reclaim all of these fallen conditioned souls to call them back to the Sanatan eternal sky, so that the Sanatan living entities may regain their eternal Sanatan positions or eternal association with the Lord. The Lord Himself comes in different incarnations, or He sends His confidential servants as sons or His associates or acharyas to reclaim the conditioned souls. Unquote. So yes, Krishna is the father of all living entities. He is not only the father of the Vaishnavas or the Hindus, or the Indians, or the human beings, or residents of the earth planet. He is the father of all species of life. Sarva yonishu kaunteya murtaya sambhavantiya tasam brahma mahadyonir aham bija pradhapita. So He is the original seed-giving father of all creation. So if Krishna is the original father, and all living entities decide to obey the father, then the family can be happy. If in a family nobody obeys the father, what can be done? What kind of family will it be? So when the children obey the father, then it's a very happy situation in the house. So also, if the living entities all cooperate to obey the father, the Supreme Father, Sri Krishna, then it is a wonderful Vaikuntha-like situation here. Prabhupada used to give the example, used to tell an anecdote, that one time there was an old man and he was quite sick, and he had a couple of sons and they were massaging him, one from the left side and one or two from the right side. And unfortunately, these two groups of sons couldn't get along with each other. So they were having their arguments even as they were massaging the poor father's body. As it is, the father was suffering and these people were quarreling. So when the sons who were massaging the left side of the body wanted to make a point to chastise the brother who was on the other side, he would reach out to the other side and pinch the father's body on that side. And when the brother on that side wanted to get back at this brother, he would reach out and pinch the father on that side. And in this way, both of them were trying to teach each other a lesson, and what happened to the poor father. So in this way, Prabhupada used to say that if you want to please the father, of course Prabhupada was talking about the spiritual master, the guru. He was talking how everyone must cooperate to serve Srila Prabhupada. In the same way, everyone must cooperate to serve Krishna. Prabhupada's desire is Krishna's desire. So that cooperation comes by helping each other in this mood, not by trying to inflict pain on each other in different ways. Because Krishna is the father of everyone. So we are all here children of that one Supreme Lord. So ultimately, when we try to harm each other, we are only harming Krishna. Of course, Krishna is not harmed by our efforts, but Krishna is not a stone. Krishna is very much conscious. So he feels the pain, although he's Atmaram. He wants his living entities, his parts and parcels, to come back to him. And when it doesn't happen, he naturally feels compassion. And therefore, he personally comes down, as Prabhupada explains here, to reclaim the fallen conditioned souls and to take everyone back to the Sanatana sky. He comes in different forms. He comes himself in incarnations, he comes through his saintly representatives, he comes through the form of the holy name, through the form of the scriptures. And that's the purpose why Krishna comes here. He also comes in the deity form to do that. And he's very patiently waiting. Every day when we go to take darshan, Krishna is there. When standing with Krishna Balaram, he's just standing there holding his flute in his hand. In his left hand is there, the flute. And when he's standing with Radharani as Shyam Sundar, he's playing his flute. And he remains there playing his flute, waiting. Every day when he goes, he's still playing the flute. With his flute, he's trying to attract us to come back to him. As if he's saying that, well, I'm waiting. And we have our time. Well, I need a little more time. Well, I have this to wind up and that to wind up. I'm not yet pure enough to come. So we have our case to plead, but Krishna is patient. I'm there, I'm here, I have descended. So he's playing his flute to attract everyone to come, just like Krishna was playing the flute at Vanshivat and all the gopis left everything and ran to him. So the same Krishna is playing the same flute here in the same Vrindavan and calling everybody, come, come, come. So he's beckoning to everybody. So Krishna has descended, he's calling, and we have to listen to his call. And the moment we do that, then we will find Krishna's presence very strongly in our life. And then the reciprocation will indeed become a great impetus for us to progress in our Krishna consciousness. And we will be firmly situated on the path back to Godhead. So we'll stop here now. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Sometimes we hear about the spiritual world and there is a spiritual world and that's a completely that's pure. But we also said that now in Germany that the devotees are concerned about the fact that we should not bother with this.
The question is that we've been hearing about how we should go back to the spiritual sky, but we also hear that here, for example, in Mahaprabhu Shikshashtakam prayers, Janmani Janmanishvare Bhavatad Bhakti Rahituki Tvai, that we don't even want liberation, we don't mind remaining here in this material world. Yes, both are all right. At the stage of pure devotion, the devotee doesn't want anything except what Krishna desires. If Krishna desires that he should stay in hell eternally, the devotee will happily be willing for that. So for devotee, nothing really changes because the only thing he does is devotional service. Narayana paraha sarve na kutaschana bibhyati svargapavarga narikeshu apitulyartha darshinaha. Lord Shiva tells Parvati in the matter of Chitraketu, Maharaj in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that for a devotee of the Lord, Narayana Paraha, all those who have become devoted to Lord Narayana, to Lord Krishna, na kutaschana bibhyati, there is no scope for any fear at any stage in life, because svarga, apavarga, narakeshu, api tulyartha darshinaha, all these different stages of the heavenly planets of liberation, or anywhere else in this material world, or even in the hellish planets, are all one. He sees with equal vision, because wherever he goes, he will only perform devotional service. So for a devotee, in one sense, it doesn't make a difference whether he is going to the spiritual world or whether he goes to any other planet in the material world. So at that platform, he only wants to just serve and please Krishna. Although the devotee is willing to go anywhere, Krishna will take him back. And even when a devotee may have some desire for perfection, it's called lalasa mai prarthana. We hear so many prayers of our acharyas who are longing for some spiritual perfection. So that is not wrong, that is quite perfect. It is good to have a longing like that. Every day, even in Tulsi prayers, we chant, right? So these lalasa mai prarthana, the seeking of some spiritual perfection, may mean also seeking to go to a particular place or to go for a particular kind of service. So that is all right, because the motive is still service, unmotivated service. However, at the same time, the devotee is willing to do anything that Krishna wants. That is the point. But yes, ultimately, the devotee does not even seek the opulences and the happiness of the spiritual world. He only wants service. But nevertheless, as a principle, because people remain in this material world out of ignorance, and they think this material world is a better place, so they are being informed. Therefore, Prabhupada takes so much pain to tell us about the spiritual sky. Unless we are sufficiently informed, how would we even know that that's the place we are supposed to be in? Unless we are told how wonderful it is and how much we should try to be there, how would we even try? So we have to get all the information. And then when we become more advanced devotees, then gradually we are not so much concerned about the physical location, where we are. But Krishna, of course, will take the devotee back. Any other point? Yes. Krishna says, yada yada hi dharmasya, that I descend in every age, and at the same time the incarnations are also fixed. So what is the question? How is it correlated? Well, there is no problem. It's just that Krishna has made schedules for himself and his incarnations. Yes, so when Krishna says yada yada hi dharmasya, every yuga I come, he means that either himself or his incarnations come. Krishna is not alone. He has so many expansions and incarnations. In every yuga there will be some form of the Lord that comes. So whenever there is a decline of religion, there is some form of the Lord that comes. So there are so many forms, and they all have their scheduled time at which they descend. Therefore, one chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam you will find scheduled incarnations. So Krishna does things according to schedule, although he is not obliged to, but he does. So all the different avatars come at different times. Generally, the principle is that each avatar descends once in a day of Brahma, although there are exceptions as well, like Varahadev and so on. Not Varahadev, Matsya avatar for example came twice, Varaha also came twice in one day of Brahma. So these are all the different timetables at which they come. So no contradiction there. Yes, one last question. Question is that it was said in regard to the fight of the demigods and the demons that when the mode of goodness becomes more powerful, then the demigods emerge victorious, and when the modes of passion and ignorance become more powerful, then the demons become victorious. The question is that we thought mode of goodness is more powerful, and also that where do the modes reside? Number one, if you read the Bhagavad Gita carefully, you will see Krishna explaining that there is always a competition between the three modes. Sometimes the mode of goodness is strong and the other two are less strong. Sometimes the mode of passion is stronger than the other two. Sometimes the mode of ignorance, sometimes a combination of the two. So at different times, different modes or their combinations are strong and they prevail. And as far as where do they reside everywhere. They are all-pervading, only in different ways. How do they change with time? They are changing every moment. For example, in the early morning, it's the mode of goodness. As the day progresses, it's the mode of passion. As the evening approaches, the mode of ignorance approaches. So even as we are sitting now, in general, we are moving towards sunset. So the mode of passion is also going down, the mode of ignorance is on the rise. So the modes are always fluctuating like this. And yes, whichever mode is strong, those who are under that influence will become strong. Like even when the incarnations of the Lord appear, and the demigods are often praying, "Oh my Lord, please kill this demon before it gets dark." Because the Rakshasas and the Asuras become powerful when it is night, because they are in the mode of ignorance, so they become more powerful. Any other point? Yes. The question is, for a pure devotee, the three modes have no influence. Yes, that is correct. For one who is completely situated on the transcendental platform, the three modes have no influence. But at the same time, even if one is a pure devotee, one still is living within the material world. So one has to respect the laws of nature. It's not that one should be casual about it. Even Prabhupada used to be very particular what time to leave, how to do things, to respect the laws of nature here in this material world. Yes, Mata. What is that? Is cooking on a high flame considered to be in the mode of passion? Well, doing anything too fast is in the mode of passion. High flame or low flame depends on what is required for cooking. Sometimes you require a high flame, sometimes you require a low flame, depending on what the item that is being cooked is. So whatever is required, we have to do. And at the same time, there are some activities that are by nature in the mode of passion. Like any act of creation is in the mode of passion. So some passion is required there. So Brahma, who is in charge of the mode of passion, is in charge of creation of the universe. Similarly, destruction is an activity that is under the influence of the mode of ignorance. Therefore, Lord Shiva, who is in charge of the mode of ignorance, he has an important responsibility in the destruction of the universe. So different activities in this world require the manipulation and the use of different modes. So we can utilize these modes in Krishna's service. If there's somebody who is very passionate, then you have to that person has to be engaged accordingly in some service that will keep his senses engaged. One time when some devotee was very quarrelsome and very aggressive and always fighting with the other devotees, Prabhupada said, send him to Haridwar and let him fight with all the Mayavadis there. Let him defeat all the Mayavadis and use his spirit of aggression and fighting with others. So according to the modes that we have to utilize it, dovetail it for Krishna's service. Not everybody is the same. So each one's propensities have to be utilized according to, for the best, to serve Krishna in the best possible way. Okay, thank you very much. Yes, one last question. How is the human being punished? Because his level is of consciousness is higher. Yes, the question is that is he punished according to the level of his consciousness? Yes. The higher you are, the harder you fall. The more is expected of you. Therefore, the political leaders, for example, they have to share the burden of 1/6 of the karma of the citizens. Why? An ordinary citizen doesn't have to share the karma of the 1/6 of the population, but the king has to share because he has that position. He has that responsibility. And he gets all that power, the prestige, the opulence, the enjoyment, everything that's available for a king, but for a price. The price is he has to discharge his responsibility as well. If he doesn't, then he has to suffer much more than the others have to suffer. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Gaur Premanande.
So many modes, so